Well, if you thought Isaiah 53 and Psalm 22 were pretty good, Daniel 9 is one of the most impressive chunks of predictive prophecy in the entire Bible. I find this to be the most incredible prediction I've ever read. I'm not an expert in religion, but I am a student of religion and comparative religion. And I have never seen anything like this in any other holy book, what we're about to read. In this regard, the prophecy of Daniel 9 stands alone. I will warn you before we get into this, though, this is a very complicated passage. We're going to use sound interpretive rules, sound hermeneutics. We're going to go and do the hard work of understanding what this passage means. But it is difficult. And I will also say we're going to go through this a lot deeper than you probably want to go. We're going to look at every critical objection I've ever read on Daniel 9. And so we're going to go really deep. But it's going to get complicated. If you want the simplified version, pick up Dennis McCallum's book, Discovering God. He's got a great chapter in there. Just lays this out in a couple pages. It's really not that complicated, but we're going to go really deep and really get at the difficult, critical objections to this passage. Okay. First thing we need to do is ask about the context of Daniel 9. Who is Daniel? Daniel was a Jewish captive being held by the Babylonian Empire. He was taken out of Babylon in roughly 600 BC. Babylon came in under King Nebuchadnezzar, raped, pillaged, burned Israel, grabbed a bunch of Hebrew boys, took them over to Babylon to make them viceroys, people who could speak Hebrew and who would also be brainwashed by Babylon with the hopes that he could send them back in there. Daniel, in other words, is living not in foreign occupation. Daniel was taken out of his home into Babylon. Well, you're probably asking yourself, aren't the Jews the holy people? Doesn't God love the Jews? Why were the Jews raped, pillaged, and destroyed? Why was their nation burned to the ground? Well, in order for the Jews to live on God's soil, on this real estate in Israel, God said, you have to play by my rules. I'm not going to protect you if you're going to be evil, if you're going to be rebellious and you're going to stray from me. He said in Leviticus 25, verses 2 through 4, when you have entered the land I am giving you, the land itself must observe a Sabbath rest before the Lord every seventh year. So in other words, when you guys get to this land, you can have the land, but you got to let it lie every seventh year. You can work 6 years, let it go the seventh year. For 6 years, you may plant your fields, prune your vineyards, and harvest your crops. But during the seventh year, the land must have a Sabbath year of complete rest. Don't touch the land on the seventh year. Leviticus 26, 34. Then at last, the land will enjoy its neglected Sabbath years as it lies desolate while you are in exile in the land of your enemies. Then the land will finally rest and enjoy the Sabbaths it missed. In Leviticus 25, God says, let the land go on the seventh year. And then in Leviticus 26, he says, you're not going to do it, and I'm going to punish you. I'm warning you right now. Well, in other words, God was saying, if you don't let that land go, I'm going to kick you out of the land, and then the land will get its rest. It's going to rest one way or the other. Either you're going to let it rest, or we're going to kick you out of this land. Well, 2 Chronicles 36, 21 says the same thing. It says, the message of the Lord spoken through Jeremiah was fulfilled. The land finally enjoyed its Sabbath rest, lying desolate until the 70 years were fulfilled, just as the prophet said. Jeremiah 25 and Jeremiah 29 said that God is going to bring judgment on the land of Israel. He's going to kick you out for 70 years. Well, let's see. If the Jews had to let the land go every seventh year, and they were kicked out for 70 years, you could see that must have been that they were disobeying this command for 490 years. For 490 years, they weren't following this command, and they were kicked out for 70. So they were in the land for roughly 800 years at this point that Daniel is writing. They disobeyed the Sabbath rest for 490, so they were kicked out for 70 years. let's pick up in Daniel 9. We've got our context. Daniel is pretty mopey. He's sad. He's been kicked out of his land for a really long time. Picks up in Daniel 9. It was the first year of the reign of Darius the Mede, the son of Ahasuerus, who became king of the Babylonians during the first year of his reign. The first year of the reign of Darius the Mede, historically, is 538-537 B.C. Now, wait a minute. Daniel was kicked out in 600 B.C. Jeremiah said that he'd be kicked out for 70 years. It's 538. It's been about 60 years, give or take. It's been almost 70 years. In the beginning of Daniel 9, Daniel's thinking, he's counting the time, he's thinking, we're almost out of here. Daniel 9, verse 2, it says, I, Daniel, learned from reading the word of the Lord as revealed to Jeremiah the prophet that Jerusalem must lie desolate for 70 years. Okay, you see how this is all fitting together. Leviticus said it. 2 Chronicles 36 said it. Jeremiah said it. Now Daniel's saying, okay, I've got Jeremiah in front of me. And I'm reading Jeremiah, and Jeremiah says that the land's going to be laid bare for 70 years. He's quoting from Jeremiah, Jeremiah 25:11. He says, this entire land will become a desolate wasteland. Israel and her neighboring lands will serve the king of Babylon for 70 years. Then after the 70 years of captivity are over, I'll punish the king of Babylon and his people for their sins, says the Lord. This is what God says. You will be in Babylon for 70 years, but then I will come and I will bring you home again. So Daniel sitting in front of his Bible, he's at Jeremiah 29:10. 70 years are almost up. We're going to get brought back into the land just as God promised right before this thing even happened. Well, then in Daniel 9:3-19, Daniel prays to God. He says, God, we've sinned. We want you to make good on your word. Bring us back into our land. And let's pick up here in verse 20. Now, while I, Daniel, was speaking and praying and confessing my sin and the sin of my people and presenting my supplication before the Lord, my God, in behalf of the holy mountain of my God, while I was still speaking in prayer, then the man Gabriel, it's an angel, whom I had seen in the vision previously, came to me in my extreme weariness about the time of the evening offering. Now, if you're a Bible student, you know that Gabriel comes up another time in the Bible. Not only does Gabriel predict this prediction about Jesus' life, he also predicts Jesus' birth in Luke 1:26-38. He predicts how Jesus would be born. Well, verse 22, he gave me instruction and talked with me and said, oh, Daniel, I've now come forth to give you insight with understanding. At the beginning of your supplications, the command was issued, and I have come to tell you, for you are highly esteemed, so give heed to the message and gain understanding of this vision. You're going to need understanding to figure this out, Daniel, us. You need some kind of wisdom to figure this out. This is not just like reading Isaiah 53. This is going to be kind of hard. Daniel 9:24, verse 24. 70 weeks have been decreed for your people and your holy city to finish the transgression, to make an end of sin, to make atonement for iniquity, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy place. So who's this prophecy for? It's for your people and your holy city, the Jews. It's for them, and it's for their city, Jerusalem. For what purpose? Well, he mentioned six things. To finish transgression, to make an end of sin, to make atonement for iniquity, to bring in righteousness, to seal up vision and prophecy, to anoint the most holy place. He's describing the work of Jesus. We could call this verse here the thesis statement. Now, many of you have been out of school for a long time, but if you remember a time back when you had to write papers, your teacher would bug you. They would say, yeah, it's a nice paper, but you didn't give me a thesis statement for the paper. That's where in just the first paragraph, in a short, concise way, you explain what you're going to talk about in the entire paper. Daniel 9:24 is just like a thesis statement. It's describing this entire work of God he's going to fulfill. verse 25. So you are to know and discern that from the issuing of a decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until Messiah the Prince, until King Messiah, Messiah the Prince, there will be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. It will be built again with plaza and moat, even in times of distress. Verse 26, then after the 62 weeks, the Messiah will be cut off and have nothing, and the people of the prince who is to come will destroy the city and the sanctuary. Okay, if we're not trying to get the specifics of Daniel 9, if we're just trying to get the big picture, what can we know? Let's just get the big picture of Daniel 9. Daniel predicted at least four things. Number one, there would be this decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem. Number two, Jerusalem would be rebuilt with plaza and moat, with its defenses. Number three, the Messiah would come to earth and he would be cut off. He would die. And finally, number four, the temple would be destroyed. Now, before we get into the specifics of this passage, just think about this. Not bad for a guy 500 years in advance. He predicted that there'd be a decree, the city would be rebuilt, the Jews would be regathered. After that, the Messiah would come, the Messiah would die, and then the temple would be destroyed. Well, Jesus Christ died in AD 33. That's the best dating for Christ's death. And the temple was destroyed in 70 AD. So if Jesus isn't the Messiah who fulfilled this prophecy, then nobody is. Malachi 3 said that God himself would enter the temple. Haggai 2, 8 and 9 says that the glory of the second temple would be greater than the glory of the first temple. What that means is not that the second temple was more beautiful, but that God himself would fill the temple. So if this passage isn't describing God coming to earth in the presence of the Messiah, then who else fits that description? He had to fit in right between the temple and the Messiah and the rebuilding of Jerusalem. Okay, not only did Daniel get these four events correct, not only did he predict that the Messiah would die before the destruction of the second temple, but scandalously, Daniel predicts the exact year that this occurred. He gets it right to the year. And what we're going to do is just start right over from the beginning. We're going to look at this verse by verse, word by word. We're going to look at what the critics say. We're going to give a well-seasoned defense of why this is talking about the death of Christ to the year. Daniel 9:25a, the first part, he says, so you are to know and to discern. You have to figure this out. Know and discern that from the issuing of a decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem. Well, which decree is he talking about? Four different decrees have been put forward. The first decree is the decree of Cyrus in Ezra 6:3, 2 Chronicles 36. Same decree. The decree of Cyrus. Ezra 6:3 says, in the first year of Cyrus, Cyrus the king issued a decree. Now, you have to read very carefully. Concerning the house of God at Jerusalem, let the temple, the place where sacrifices are offered, be rebuilt and let its foundations be retained. Some people think this is the decree. What did Daniel say? The decree to restore and rebuild the temple? No, to restore and rebuild Jerusalem, the city. This cannot be the decree. The house of God at Jerusalem is the temple. Let the temple, the place where sacrifices are offered, let that be rebuilt. The decree of Cyrus cannot be the decree. It's talking about the temple. What about number two, the decree of Darius? Ezra 6, 8 and 9 states, moreover, I issue a decree concerning what you are to do for these elders of Judah in rebuilding of this house of God. Is that talking about the city? The house of God? Well, let's keep reading. Whatever is needed, both young bulls, rams, and lambs, for a burnt offering to the God of heaven, as the priests in Jerusalem request. What's this describing? You don't have to be a theologian. Is it talking about the city? No. It's talking about bulls, rams, lambs, burnt offering. It's talking about the temple, the rebuilding of the temple, and that the temple will be furnished with the right sacrifices. What about number three, the decree of Artaxerxes, the first decree in Ezra 7:13? Ezra 7 says, I have issued a decree that any of the people of Israel and their priests and the Levites in my kingdom who are willing to go to Jerusalem, they go with you. Is this talking about Jerusalem? What did Daniel say? The issuing of a decree to restore and rebuild the city with plaza and moat. He even says the defenses are going to be up on the city. This is talking about the priests and the Levites going to the kingdom. It can't be decrees number one, two, or three. That leaves us with decree number four, the second decree of Artaxerxes, found in Nehemiah chapter 2. Nehemiah 2 records the decree of Artaxerxes. It says, and it came about in the month Nisan, in the 20th year of Artaxerxes, that wine was before him, and I took up the wine. Okay, the 20th year of King Artaxerxes can be accurately dated to 444 B.C. It gives the month, it gives the year. Artaxerxes was a famous king. That can be dated to 444 B.C. Thucydides, who's called the prince of historians, and Herodotus, who's called the king of historians, both mention King Artaxerxes. If you open up any encyclopedia, or if you're a lazy person, open up any Wikipedia, you can find Herodotus. He's mentioned as reigning, taking over his father's reign, Xerxes, if you've ever seen 300, the guy who's 12 foot tall, kind of strange. He takes over for him in December of 465 B.C. In the 20th year of his reign, in the month Nisan, it's 444 B.C. That can be accurately dated through secular history, not biblical history, secular. Okay, Nehemiah 2, verse 2. So the king said to me, why is your face sad and though you're not sick? King, live forever. Why should my face not be sad when the city, the place of my father's tombs, lies desolate and its gates have been consumed by fire? Is this talking about the temple? No, it's talking about the city. Then the king said to me, what would you request? So I prayed to God of heaven. I said to the king, if it please the king, and if your servant has found favor before you, send me to Judah, to the city of my father's tombs, that I may rebuild it. He's not talking about the temple, the city. Then the king said to me, the queen sitting behind him, how long will your journey be? Blah, 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 blah. Okay, verse 7. If it please the king, let letters be given me for the governors of the provinces beyond the river. I want a written decree from the king, a decree for the city. Verse 8, a letter to Asaph, the keeper of the king's forest, and he may give me timber to make the beams for the walls, for the wall of the city. Rebuilding the city, not the temple. I talked to some guys down at the Free Thought Movement on campus, a skeptical group. How do you know it's not the decree of Cyrus? How do you know it's not the decree of Darius? Dude, it doesn't mention the city. Nehemiah mentions the city. Here's three more reasons why this is the right decree. Later in Nehemiah 2, verses 13 and 17, Nehemiah shows up to Jerusalem. Guess what he finds? A completely reconstructed city because it had already been given under the earlier decrees? No. He shows up to Jerusalem. It's on fire. It's completely destroyed. If the decree was either decree 1, 2, or 3, then how is it that Nehemiah could show up and the city is completely made desolate? Couldn't be an earlier decree. Secondly, Daniel 9:25 predicts that this would be rebuilt even in times of distress. And if you read on in the book of Nehemiah, it says that the builders were building the walls, the fortress, the moat of the city of Jerusalem. They've got their sword in one hand and they've got their trowel and their shovel in the other. They're being attacked and they have to protect their city, just as Daniel predicted. Leon Wood, a commentator, says, well, maybe it was like spiritual distress. That's not what it says. It says literal distress. They're being attacked. Moreover, we can point out that in Ezra 4:21, Artaxerxes told the Jews to stop rebuilding their city, quote, until a decree is issued by me. So some Jews probably started to rebuild the city, and Artaxerxes said, nuh-uh, can't do that. I'm the king. You got to wait until I give you a decree to do this. So he stopped rebuilding of the city until the decree was given. Walter Kaiser, this is from his book, The Messiah in the Old Testament, a respected Hebrew scholar, says that, quote, this beginning date has been variously placed, but most prefer to begin with the 20th year of Artaxerxes' reign in 445 B.C., Nehemiah 2. In other words, he's saying most people who handle this passage say it is Nehemiah 2. It's not really that disputed. John Walvoord, from Dallas Theological Seminary, he was an Old Testament scholar. He says, quote, any date earlier than 445 B.C. for rebuilding the wall is based on insufficient evidence. Okay, now wait a minute. Both of these guys said 445 B.C. You said 444. This is really tricky. Well, you have to compare Nehemiah 1:1 with Nehemiah 2:1. In Nehemiah 1:1, it says that Nehemiah was in Artaxerxes' 20th year in November. Okay? He's in the 20th year of Artaxerxes in November. What year would that be? He took over in December of 465. November, 20 years later, would be 445. But then Nehemiah 2:1 says that he's still in the 20th year of Artaxerxes in April. We were in the 20th year in November, December, January. Well, wouldn't that be 444? Well, why does he say the 20th year in Nehemiah 2? Well, the Jews didn't measure their years the same way we do. They didn't go from January till January. Otherwise, crossing over January would have brought you to the 21st year. Here's a picture to describe it. Artaxerxes takes over in 465 B.C. Nehemiah 1:1 is right before 445. And then Nehemiah 2:1 crosses over the new year into 444 B.C. I don't think that should be that disputed. We're just putting our calendar on their system. We're trying to figure out how they do it themselves. Okay, so let's get our timeline out, the specific timeline. When was this decree? From the issuing of a decree, 444 B.C. Daniel 9:25b, until Messiah the Prince. So from the issuing of a decree, 444 B.C., until Messiah the Prince. Well, the critics come back and say, wait a minute. How do we know that this is talking about the Messiah? Maybe it's just talking about a Messiah, not the Messiah. You know, the term Mashiach, the term anointed one, is used throughout the whole Old Testament. Sometimes the priest is called the Mashiach, the anointed one. Sometimes David is the Mashiach. Isaiah 45 says that the bloodthirsty King Cyrus was God's anointed one. How do you know this is talking about the Messiah? Well, there's a number of reasons we should believe that this is talking about the Messiah, not just a Messiah or an anointed one. Number one, the Septuagint translates this passage as Tau Christou, the Messiah. Is this a Christian conspiracy? No. It's a Jewish translation, 200 years before Christ, translating this as the Messiah. The modern Orthodox Jewish translation, the Stone Edition. The Stone Edition, it's a very reliable Orthodox Jewish translation, translates Daniel 9:25 as the Anointed One, the Messiah. When you look at the Hebrew words Mashiach and Najid, Messiah the Prince, separately they could refer to two separate things, the Messiah and Anointed One, or Prince, Najid. But when you put the expression together, they become a compound phrase, Mashiach Najid, means King Messiah, the Anointed One. It'd be like the words butter and fly. When you put butter and fly together, they become a compound word, butterfly, or milk and shake. When you put them together, they become a compound word. Mashiach Najid means King Messiah. So we've got the decree until who? The Messiah shows up. Daniel 9:25c. How long of a time is there going to be? Well, there will be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. It will be built again with plaza and moat, even in times of distress. Now we have to answer the question. What does Daniel mean by weeks? What does he mean by weeks? Well, the Hebrew word here is Shabuah. Shabuah. Well, when Daniel says that there will be 7 weeks, does he mean 7 times 7 days? 62 times 7 days? Or does he mean 67 times 7 years? Well, the term Shabuah in Hebrew literally just means a set of seven. A set of seven. In order to know what the Hebrew word Shabuah is referring to, you need a referent. It's kind of like the English word dozen. If I said, yeah, I just picked up a dozen the other day, you'd say, a dozen what? A dozen eggs, a dozen cans of beer, a dozen donuts. What kind of a dozen? Well, the Hebrew word Shabuah is the same thing. It just means a set of seven. Just like the word dozen means a set of 12. The word Shabuah is used in Genesis 29:27 to refer to a set of 7 years. There's just one example. When Jacob goes to work for Laban, do you think he worked for 168 hours? No, it says that he worked for a Shabuah, a set of 7 years, not days. When we look at the word Shabuah, what we have to do is look at the context. Well, what is the context of Daniel 9? If you remember, the Jews were kicked out of their land for how long? 70 days? No, 70 years. Well, they were kicked out for disobeying for how long? 490 days? No, they were kicked out for 490 years. When understanding the word Shabuah, you have to look at the context. Up until this point, Daniel was thinking about a Shabuah of years, a set of 7 years. Later in chapter 10, verse 2, the next verse after this, Daniel says, I was weeping, I was mourning for 3 Shabuah of days. I was weeping for 21 days, for 3 weeks. The fact that right after this passage, he says 3 Shabuah of days implies that he wasn't thinking about Shabuah of days before, that he's changing themes in chapter 10. He must have been referring to years in chapter 9 and moving into days in chapter 10. Finally, number 5, this series of events doesn't fit in a 483-day period. When you add this up together, there's no way that they could get back into their land, rebuild the temple, rebuild the city, rebuild everything in a year and a half. John 2, it says that just to rebuild the temple, it took 46 years. It took forever. There's no way that all these events could fit into a year and a half period. Edward Young, now this is a Christian theologian. This is from his commentary, Prophecy of Daniel. He says on page 196, the prophecy upon this view would become practically meaningless. Hence, as far as the present writer knows, this view is almost universally rejected. So the idea that we're talking about a Shabuah of days, according to him, that view is just, nobody believes that view, whether you're a critic or a Christian. Nobody thinks that Daniel was predicting days rather than years. John Walvoord says, the overwhelming consensus of scholarship agrees that the time unit should be considered years. Now, they're Christians, but they're speaking on behalf of the scholarly community, whether you're a Christian or a critic. Nobody believes this is talking about days. This part of the prophecy, in other words, is not that disputed. Virtually no scholar holds that view. Okay, so 7 weeks means 7 times 7 years, and 62 weeks means 62 times 7 years. Here's a question. Why not just say 69 sevens? Why say 7 weeks and 62 weeks? Why add these two numbers together? What's the purpose? Well, we could say the same thing of Abraham Lincoln. You know, Abraham Lincoln gave a really famous speech, the Gettysburg Address. Why didn't Lincoln just say, 87 years ago, our fathers brought forth upon this continent a new nation? Why did he have all that gobbledygook of 87 years ago? 84, that's 4 times 20 plus 7. Why be so confusing? Well, Lincoln was just using a literary convention that was common to his day. That's the way you talked back then. Daniel was living 2,500 years ago. He didn't talk the way we do. He had his own system of speaking, his own system of adding numbers together. That was the way that he chose to do it. Probably because the city took seven Shabuah to rebuild. It took 62 Shabuah to get to the point of the Messiah. Okay, so how much time is this predicting? We've already given it away. 7 weeks is 49 years. 7 times 7. Does somebody have a calculator on their phone? All right. 7 times 7, I can do that. I don't need to be a mathematical wizard to do that. What about 62 weeks times 7? 62 times 7, 434 years. So if we add those together, 49 plus 434, that's 483, right? Okay. So Daniel is predicting a 483-year gap from the decree, 444, to the Messiah. So here we go, the decree, 444 B.C. Jerusalem's going to be rebuilt, plaza and moat, 483 years until Mashiach Najid, Messiah the Prince. So what's 444 minus 483? Negative 39, so that would be A.D. 39. Okay, now Jesus died in A.D. 33. But Daniel was predicting this almost 500 years in advance. Give him a break. He's off by 6 years. Not that bad. I mean, pretty good guess. Could you predict something like that and be 6 years off? It's pretty good. Well, we forgot one thing. The Jews didn't use our calendar system. The Gregorian calendar wasn't invented until the 15 or 1600s. The Jews weren't on a solar calendar. They did not use that. Now this, I will admit, the points up to this point, critics don't really go after. The decree, the Messiah, I mean, those parts are pretty much universally agreed upon. This part is the section of the prophecy that is most disputed, whether the Jews used our calendar system or not. I'm going to give you three reasons why the Jews used a 360-day calendar rather than a 365-day calendar. The first reason is that other ancient nations used a lunar calendar, which in some cases is a 354-day year, and in other cases, a 360-day year. India, Persia, Babylonia, Assyria, and Egypt did not use a 365-day year the way we do today, a solar calendar. Where was Daniel when he was writing this prophecy? Well, he was in Persia. But who originally took over Israel? Babylon. The Babylonians took over Israel. They probably inculcated their view, their calendar system, into Israel. Daniel was thinking in terms not of a 365-day year, but of 360. Second, historically, the Jews used a 360-day year. When you compare Genesis 7:11 with Genesis 8:3, it says that 5 months equals 150 days. Noah equated 5 months with 150 days. So first, the other nations didn't use a 365-day calendar. Number two, the Jews, here's an example of them actually equating 5 months with 150 days. Thirdly, prophetically, the Jews used a 360-day calendar. If you compare Revelation 11:2 and Revelation 13:5 with Revelation 12:6 and 11:3, we find that John equated 42 months with 1,260 days. They used a 30-day month for their calendar, 360 days total. Now, here's the point. We would never assume when we read the Bible that the ancient Jews had our modern scientific knowledge, would we? We would never assume that. Okay, we would never assume that the ancient Jews had our modern medical knowledge, would we? Then why would we ever assume that the ancient Jews used our calendar? They didn't. They didn't use a 365-day year. It's debated whether they used a 354-day year, which is a solid lunar calendar, or a 360-day year, which, for the reasons I've given, I think it's 360. But it's either or. But there's no way of saying that they used a 365-day solar calendar. When they looked retrospectively, the Jews would put in a 13th month every so often, kind of like our leap year. We put in an extra day every 4 years. But when they looked prospectively into the future, they didn't adjust their calendar in this way, which is what we see in Revelation 11 and 13. Okay, so 444 B.C., until Mashiach Najid, Messiah the Prince. Well, we've got to convert 483 years to our modern calendar system. So, 483 times 360, which is the calendar they used, which is what? Okay, 173,880. Now we got to take that number and divide it by 365, which is putting it on our calendar system. 476.3 something. Okay, can we round down? 476 years, 476.3 solar years. So 444 minus 476 is what? 32 A.D. Okay. Now, Jesus died in 33 A.D., not 32 A.D. Again, not bad for a guy 500 years in advance. That's pretty close. Only a year off. I'd like to see you predict something like that. A year off. Well, we forgot one more thing. On the calendar, and this is not disputed at all, on the calendar, there is no such thing as a zero year. There just isn't. Okay. When you cross over from B.C. to A.D., 4, 3, 2, 1, there is no zero year. As we explained it here, zero is the signifier between 2 years. No one was living in 0 B.C., 0 A.D. You were either living in December 31st, 1 B.C., or January 1st, 1 A.D. There's no zero year. It isn't the dashes that need to be counted on a timeline. It's the spaces. It's the time in between. So there's no zero year. That's not disputed. It's just not on the calendar. Okay, so 444 minus 476, accounting for the zero year, brings us to 33 AD, the preferred date for Jesus' death on the cross. But Daniel isn't done. He goes on to write, then after the 62 weeks, the Messiah will be cut off and have nothing. Okay, so the Messiah is going to be killed. Kind of a strange way to describe the Messiah. Messiah is dead. And the people of the prince who is to come will destroy the city and the sanctuary. Well, this happened, of course, in AD 70. Happened only 37 years after this whole thing happened. He predicted that in the right order. They're going to destroy the city and the temple. So the specific timeline looks like this. We've got the decree, 444 B.C. We've got the rebuilding of Jerusalem, 476 years. Messiah dies, AD 33. Messiah will be cut off, killed. And then AD 70, the people of the prince who is to come, which is Rome, that's who did it, will destroy the city and the sanctuary. This all happened exactly as Daniel predicted, down to the year. This would be similar to a Puritan settler predicting the modern presidential candidates. Yeah, I think in 2012 it's going to be Romney versus Obama, okay? If somebody could predict the stock market with this much clairvoyance, you'd suspect them of insider trading. You'd suspect that they had some kind of inside details. Okay, Daniel predicted something 500 years in advance. Isn't it probable that Daniel had some insider information on this whole thing? What exactly did Daniel predict? Well, let's just think about it like this. Even if the details are wrong, let's say it's a 354-day calendar, not a 360. Okay, that would take you to about 26 A.D. That's still pretty close. Even if these details are wrong, Daniel still predicted these events in their proper order and pretty close. I mean, he hits right to the time of Jesus' death. Secular historians confirm the date of Jesus' death to the early 30s A.D. Tacitus, Lucian, and the Babylonian Talmud all reference this person, Jesus, who was put to death in this specific time. Tacitus mentions that Jesus died at the hands of Pontius Pilatus, which is the Latin rendering of Pontius Pilate, who reigned from 27 to 36. He says he died under Emperor Tiberius, who reigned from 27 to 37, somewhere in there. Lucian mentions a crucified leader. Babylonian Talmud says that Jesus was killed. He was hanged, which is an expression for killed. The Bible uses that expression, Galatians 3. So Greeks, Jews, and Romans all attest to Jesus dying in the 30s AD. It's not that the Bible is fulfilling the Bible. Here we've got extra-biblical historians mentioning Jesus of Nazareth. Even hostile critic Bart Ehrman, this guy debates Christians, basically says how the Bible is full of bull. Even critical scholar Bart Ehrman, in his book, Did Jesus Exist? He writes this on page 98, that Jesus died, quote, almost certainly from the 30s of the Common Era. Ehrman, in his book, he's a critic, he's an agnostic atheist. He says it's ridiculous to say Jesus never lived. You see the title of his book, Did Jesus Exist? He says if you're a historian and you say that he didn't, he said you're a laughingstock in your community. He says there's no credible historian who denies that Jesus lived. And he said he died almost certainly in the early 30s A.D. Thirdly, Daniel successfully predicted the death of the world's most influential man. Isn't that just a little bit creepy? Okay. The guy who turned the world on its head. The guy who influenced more people than anyone else who's ever lived. This guy has his death predicted 500 years in advance in the Hebrew Bible. You know, some people say, well, actually, Muhammad was more influential than Jesus. I don't see how that works, because Christianity, according to Muslims, gave birth to Islam. Christianity is a bigger religion, and it's been around longer, and it's influenced more people. It's ridiculous. Here's the way H.G. Wells writes. He's an atheistic author, historian. He says, I'm a historian. I'm not a believer. But I must confess, as a historian, that this penniless preacher from Nazareth is irrevocably the very center of history. Jesus Christ is easily the most dominant figure in all of human history. Historian Philip Schaff writes, this Jesus of Nazareth, without money and arms, conquered more millions than Alexander, Caesar, Muhammad, and Napoleon. Without science and learning, he shed more light on things human and divine than all philosophers and scholars combined. Without the eloquence of schools, he spoke such words of life as were never spoken before or since, and produced effects which lie beyond the reach of orator or poet. Without writing a single line, he set more pens in motion and furnished themes for more sermons, orations, discussions, learned volumes, works of art, and the songs of praise than the whole army of great men of ancient and modern times. Now think about that. How could Daniel have predicted the death of this guy? Well, I know where I stand on that question. Let's open it up for a little bit of questions. We've got 7 minutes to spare. I thought for sure we were going to go over. Yeah. Okay, so the question is, some historians place Jesus' death at 30 rather than 33. Why would we prefer that Jesus died in 33 over 30? It could either be 27, 30, 33, or 36, because Jesus died on a Friday at Passover. So it places you on one of those four dates. 27 is too early. 36 is too late. It has to be in one of the middle two numbers. So it takes you down to 30 or 33. There's a historical argument that the biblical New Testament picture of Pontius Pilate is contrary to what extra-biblical sources say about him. The extra-biblical sources say that Pilate was a cruel anti-Semite. He hated the Jews. At one particular time, he ordered that a bunch of Jews get beaten with clubs. He put pictures of Tiberius's face in and near the temple. He was just really cruel to the Jews. So in John chapter 19, when the Jews come up to Pilate and they say, "You must crucify this man," Pilate bends over like a little sissy and he's like, "Sure, whatever you want. I'll crucify him if that's what you want." And the Jews actually say to him, "You're no friend of Caesar if you don't crucify Jesus of Nazareth." Well, for years, critics would say, "See, that's not the historical Pilate. The historical Pilate, if a bunch of Jews came up to him, he would have given them the middle finger. He would have said, 'I'm not doing anything you say,' just out of spite, because he was so anti-Semitic." Well, what we find is that there was a friend of Emperor Tiberius named Sejanus. He was really the first in command below the emperor. Emperor Tiberius lived out on the island of Capri. He was getting drunk, participating in orgies. He was just living the really fully hedonistic life. While he left the empire to Emperor or to Sejanus, Lucius Sejanus, and he told Sejanus, "Okay, Sejanus, you just run the empire while I go get drunk and get laid and do everything else under the sun, okay?" What he found out is that Sejanus was doing all the work, and Sejanus finally woke up one day and said, "Why am I doing all the work if he's the emperor?" So Sejanus tried to orchestrate a coup where he was going to kill the Roman Emperor Tiberius. Emperor Tiberius heard about this on the island of Capri, got his men together. They told Lucian that they were going to bring the emperor and kill him. They brought Lucius Sejanus in, and they had him executed along with all of his followers in 31 A.D. After 31 A.D., all of the people that were connected with Sejanus were thought of as traitors. So they looked at anyone that Sejanus appointed, that he was colleagues with, that he was friends with, and Emperor Tiberius wondered, "If you got appointed by Sejanus, I bet you're going to try and come and kill me too." Well, history tells us that Pontius Pilate was appointed by none other than Lucius Sejanus. Okay, so in other words, Pilate was walking on eggshells around Emperor Tiberius. If he made one false move, he was going to be in hot water. He could be killed because he was buds with Sejanus. Oh, one more thing. In order for anyone to get a hold of the emperor and appeal to the emperor, they had to go through Sejanus. And Sejanus was an anti-Semite too. So if the Jews came up in John 19 and said, "We want you to kill Jesus," in AD 30, Pilate would have said, "Says who? Who cares? I'm not going to do anything you want." He wouldn't have been such a wuss. But if this had happened in AD 33, then that would mean that Pilate was walking on eggshells, and that expression, "You're no friend of Caesar if you don't kill him," that would mean that you are actually supporting someone who's against Caesar, and Pilate didn't want to get in hot water. Because of the argument from Lucius Sejanus, many of them go to 33. It's about 50-50, so yeah. Okay, so the question is, why do we convert the 483 to solar years but not 444? Well, 444 is already on our calendar. That's already on the solar calendar, so the 483 would have to be converted because that's the years he was using. That's a very good question, though. Yeah. So what do Jewish interpreters do with this idea that there's going to be an atonement for sin and that sort of thing? I'll give you the short answer, and then I'll keep the long answer for next week. The short answer is some of them, because they pick different decrees, they can bring it to different times, and there is a priest, Onias III, who was killed, I believe it was 160, it was during the Maccabean era. And so he died, and they say that he was kind of like God's anointed who was killed for the people. And so there's kind of an argument there. Some critics break this up into two different messiahs, that there was a messiah predicted in verse 25 and an entirely different messiah in verse 26, based on a Hebrew punctuation mark called an athnach. But of course, that was not inspired. Those were not added until 100 years later, or sorry, 1,000 years later by the Masoretes. And there's a number of other reasons. I'll have to give you that later. I've got like five reasons why the athanach punctuation should not affect it. It's talking about the same Messiah. You would expect the author to say there's two Messiahs if that was the case. So they try and split it up in that way. Right? Last one. Very, very good question. The question is, do we have manuscript textual evidence for Daniel 9? I'm going to have to save that question for next week. I'll give you my word that there are 8 different manuscripts that Peter Flint and James Vanderkam, who are experts on Dead Sea Scrolls, say that these 8 manuscripts are almost word for word identical with the Masoretic text. They were found in the Dead Sea Scrolls. So we have 8 different copies of Daniel. They're not complete copies, though. They are separate copies. So they'll be partial copies of the book of Daniel. However, we have commentaries. There's the pseudo-Ezekiel document, which is an Essene commentary. There's the... I'm going to have to say this. I got it all for next week. And we're going to go through objections to prophecy, where we're going to go through the manuscript evidence. I will say all 3 of these passages we looked at have manuscripts which date before the time of Christ, Isaiah being the best. So next week, we're going to be looking at objections to prophecy. We're just going to spend an entire week saying, you know, how do we know that Jesus didn't self-fulfill these prophecies? How do we know the disciples didn't lie about it? How do we know that this wasn't changed? How do we know this wasn't a lucky guess or whatever? So next class won't be for 2 weeks.